of San Francisco on June 14th of 2004. As a 2009 voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, Janet brings her district's perspective to policy discussions in Washington. She is a professor emeritus at the UC Berkeley campus, where she was the Eugene E. and Catherine M. Trefethen Professor of Business and Professor of Economics, and has been a faculty member since 1980. She had earlier taken leave from Berkeley for 5 years, starting in August of 1994, when she served as a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System through February of 1997, and then left the Fed to become chair of the Council of Economic Advisers through August of 1999. She also has chaired the Economic Policy Committee of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development from 1997 to 1999. Janet graduated summa cum laude from Brown University with a degree in economics in 1967 and received her Ph.D. in economics from Yale University in 1971. She received the Wilbur Cross Medal from Yale in 1997, an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from Brown in 1998, and an honorary Doctor of Humane Letters from Bard College in 2000. An assistant professor at Harvard University from 71 to 76, Janet served as an economist with the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors in 1977 and 78, and on the faculty of the London School of Economics and Political Science from 1978 to 1980. Janet has written on a wide variety of macroeconomic issues while specializing in the causes, mechanisms, and implications of unemployment. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Janet Yellen.
Tom, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. And I'm very glad to be here tonight before such a thoughtful and engaged audience to talk about the economy and the Federal Reserve's response. The Fed has faced extraordinary challenges over the past 2 years, and these challenges continue as this very painful recession grinds on. I'm sure I don't have to tell you how difficult these times have been for the American people. You're reminded of it every time you look at your retirement portfolio or you hear about rising foreclosures and plunging home values. Your businesses may be squeezed as customers retreat and credit remains scarce. You may have seen colleagues get pink slips, or you yourselves may be struggling to find a job. I'm happy to offer some good news, which is that we've seen encouraging signs lately that the economy is poised to turn the corner. But as California's 11.5% unemployment rate attests, we still find ourselves slogging through the starkest economic landscape most of us have known in our lifetimes. For economic policymakers, this crisis has been like a 100-year flood, a disaster of the highest order, which has put us on a continuous emergency footing. This is especially true with the Federal Reserve, the institution where I serve as one of 12 regional bank presidents. We're charged with promoting maximum employment and controlling inflation. Later in my talk, I'll describe how we've responded to what not so long ago seemed perilously close to financial and economic meltdown. For now, I'll just say that in the face of unprecedented challenges, we've developed a number of creative programs far beyond the confines of our usual focus on interest rates. And we've done that to make sure that everything that reasonably could be done to get the economy turned around is being done. I want to start by discussing where the economy has been and where I see it going over the next few years. And I want to say at the outset that my comments represent my own views and not necessarily those of my colleagues in the Federal Reserve System. To understand where we're headed, I think it's useful to review how we got to the present situation. And I think it's helpful to divide the recent turmoil, like a play, into three acts. My hope is that the curtain is now rising on the final act, one that's defined by economic recovery. Well, let's start with the first act. The first act began early in the new century amid a frenzied housing boom and a mortgage market where loans were available to just about anyone on unbelievably generous terms. Interest rates were unusually low, partly because of a huge supply of foreign savings that flooded the United States market, and partly because the Fed promoted very low interest rates after the tech bubble burst to prevent deflation. With money so cheap, investors borrowed to the hilt, and they took ever greater risks in search of higher returns. It may be that investors, and regulators too, became overly complacent. Many had come to believe that the new and mind-bendingly complex forms of financial engineering that had swept Wall Street, that they virtually guaranteed the safety of banks and investment firms. A new era had dawned. Financial innovation and sophisticated risk management appeared to have changed the rules. What's more, the business cycle had been tamed. For two decades, recessions had been rare and mild. And this whole process fed on itself. In the housing market, loan standards became increasingly lax. Investors had an insatiable appetite for securities created from home loans. They bought them by the truckload from institutions that made the loans, even though they offered returns just a shade higher than ultra-safe U.S. Treasury securities. These risky practices spread far beyond the subprime mortgage market where they were most visible, and they reached into all kinds of credit products around the world. Well, this brings us to the second act of the play. House prices leapt higher every year thanks to this frothy financial market. But they couldn't go up forever. And once they started to fall in 2006, loan delinquencies surged, and the sophisticated financial engineering collapsed. The financial system spread those losses like a runaway infection. Banks and investment firms around the world saw the value of their housing-related investments plummet. In some cases, that threatened their solvency. The financial engineering was so unfathomable that it was nearly impossible to identify which institutions were safe and which were in jeopardy. And that prompted financial firms to hunker down and to avoid lending money to anybody. All of this came to a head last fall. The weakest links in the financial chain were unable to borrow the money they needed to meet day-to-day obligations. And this is a classic liquidity crisis. And when the venerable Wall Street firm Lehman Brothers collapsed, that was the point at which the system broke down entirely. The financial markets that banks and businesses rely on to fund daily operations froze up. The value of investments held by financial institutions plunged as everyone tried to sell whatever they could to raise cash. Even the most solid institutions feared for their lives. Now, such a breakdown of the financial system had the direst possible implications for the broader economy because it threatened to choke off credit to households and Main Street businesses. For Congress, the Fed, the Treasury Department, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, it was a signal to take emergency steps to keep credit flowing to the economy. Congress approved the TARP program, and it was quickly used to provide capital to banks. And the Fed created never-before-seen programs to stabilize money market mutual funds and the short-term commercial paper market. In addition, the Fed and Treasury jointly intervened to support important institutions whose collapse was judged to threaten the entire financial system. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about the alphabet soup of Fed programs that were created during this period, but I want to stress that these policies, and in some cases they were improvised in very short order, these programs and policies did succeed in averting a full-blown meltdown. The panic of 2008 subsided. Increasingly, banks and corporations have been able to raise funds on reasonable terms, and confidence in the financial system is slowly returning. Still, our brush with financial collapse came at great cost. As financial institutions struggled to survive, they cut back on lending, and private securitization markets seized up entirely. These are markets in which a variety of types of loans, that includes auto, student, credit card, small business, jumbo mortgage, and commercial real estate loans, these loans are packaged as securities and sold to investors. The resulting massive credit crunch caused the economy to nosedive in the final quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year. Job losses reached more than 700,000 per month, and the unemployment rate skyrocketed to levels we haven't seen since the early 1990s, reaching 9.4% nationally in May. Some 6 million jobs vaporized during the recession, and each of them was held by a real human being who probably depended on that paycheck to pay the mortgage, to buy groceries, and put gas in the car. The loss of these jobs is an immense tragedy, and we should never forget that this awful recession is a flesh and blood thing. It's robbing our families, neighbors, and friends of their livelihood. Earlier, I described some of the emergency measures the Fed took to prop up the financial system. Now I'd like to talk about the policies we've adopted to fight the recession directly. Our policymaking body is called the Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, and it consists of the Fed's presidents of the regional banks, like me, plus the governors of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, including Chairman Ben Bernanke. Traditionally, our main monetary policy tool is the federal funds rate. That's what banks charge each other for overnight loans. We control this rate by pumping cash into the banking system or by withdrawing it. This is a powerful tool because the interest banks pay to borrow determines what they charge for loans, and that ultimately works its way through to the rates businesses and households pay for credit. This December, we cut the federal funds rate essentially to zero. This is an extraordinary step on its own. And we've said repeatedly that low rates would likely be warranted for an extended period. As a result, many other interest rates in the economy are at very low levels. Other major central banks have taken similar steps. Still, given the depth of the crisis we have faced, a near-zero federal funds rate hasn't been enough to turn the economy around. So we've developed a variety of alternative ways to stimulate the economy. For example, we've become major buyers of securities issued by the giant mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that's a move that has helped push conforming mortgage interest rates to near record low levels. That's a support to the housing sector, which is under tremendous duress. In addition, the FOMC launched a program to purchase large quantities of longer-term Treasury debt. The object there is to help bring down corporate bond and other rates that are linked to Treasury yields. In total, the FOMC has committed up to $1.75 trillion, yes, that is trillion with a T, for these asset purchases by the end of this year. The Fed and other government bodies have also worked hard to put our banking sector on a more secure footing. The recent stress tests of the 19 largest U.S. banks provided a thorough evaluation of their financial health and capital needs. And since these tests were completed, many banks have raised capital or issued debt without FDIC guarantees. That's a very encouraging sign. In addition, the Fed and the Treasury Department jointly developed the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, or TALF, program for short. The object is to revive these vital securitization markets. Securitization is one of the great financial innovations of the last generation. It greatly expanded the market for these loans and reduced their cost compared with the days when banks and other frontline lenders had to keep such credits in their own portfolios. I think there's no question that securitization of certain types of loans, like subprime mortgages, contributed to the crisis we have. But we have to be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Securitization markets will continue to play a major role in our financial system. As I mentioned, in the midst of the financial storm late last year, these markets froze up entirely, with the exception of the market for mortgage-backed securities issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that made it tough, if not impossible, for ordinary people to borrow to buy a car, to pay college tuition, or finance a business. Restoring securitization markets to health is one of the key challenges we face. Our TALF program got off to a slow start, but I think it's now clearly helping to bring down the rates that people pay on a wide range of securitized loan products. Well, that takes me now to the third act, in which the economy hopefully recovers. Right now, we're like a patient in intensive care whose condition is stabilized, and our fever is just starting to come down. We're just completing the sixth quarter of recession, but the pace of decline has slowed markedly. The news during the past few months has been encouraging. Even though house prices are continuing to fall in most markets, housing sales and new construction appear to have stabilized. Consumers have recovered some spirit, and their spending is also stabilized. That's thanks in part to government stimulus programs. Payrolls are still shrinking at an awful pace, but the momentum of job losses has slowed considerably in the past 2 months. Financial markets are in much better shape today than we ever would have dreamed 6 months ago. Investors have gone from disregarding risk to being paralyzed by it to once again being willing to take on a reasonable bit of risk. The stock market has rallied, and investor appetite for corporate bonds and other assets has rebounded, and that's restored access to capital, at least for healthy companies. Even so, I am concerned that mortgage rates, which have risen of late, could place a drag on a still very sick housing market, potentially driving home prices still lower and pushing more borrowers into foreclosure. The recent run-up in oil prices may also reflect greater confidence in the global outlook, but it too is troublesome because it impedes recovery by forcing consumers and businesses to pay more for gas and energy, and thereby reducing their ability to buy other goods and services. Still, I expect the recession will end sometime this year. That would make it the longest and probably the deepest downturn since the Great Depression. Growth will come from a variety of sources. One is federal government spending, resulting from the stimulus program that Congress passed earlier this year. That package provides tax cuts that leave more cash in consumers' pockets and direct government spending increases that will add to payrolls and boost economic output. But it's going to take more than fiscal policy to really get the economy moving forward. Fortunately, some sectors are poised to rebound. For example, the auto industry has cut back production so far that inventories have begun to shrink even in the face of historically weak demand for motor vehicles. As the economy stabilizes, just slowing this pace of inventory shrinkage will boost gross domestic product, or GDP, which is the nation's total output of goods and services. And this is a story that holds through broad sectors of the economy, where cautious consumers and businesses have cut back on purchases of durable goods like computers and appliances. Eventually, old and broken down goods will need to be replaced, and the resulting demand will add to economic growth. The housing sector also will eventually rise from the ashes. Home construction has fallen dramatically over the past few years as the nation has been working off the massive overbuilding of the boom years. But once this adjustment is complete, housing construction is going to have to increase significantly just to keep pace with the growth in the number of households. Finally, the vicious cycle we've had of tight credit leading to a weaker economy and weakening credit, that's something that can turn into a virtuous cycle going in the other direction. Once the economy starts growing and jobs and income are increasing, fewer borrowers will default and lenders will be willing to increase the supply of credit. Now, I don't like taking the wind out of the sails of our economic expansion, but a few cautionary points have to be considered. In particular, I expect the pace of the recovery will be frustratingly slow. It's often the case that growth in the first year after a recession is very rapid. That's what happened when we came out of a very deep downturn in the early 1980s. And of course, I sincerely wish we would repeat that performance, but I don't think we will. In past deep recessions, the Fed was able to step on the accelerator by cutting the federal funds rate sharply. That caused the economy to shoot ahead. But this time, we already have our foot planted firmly on the floor, and we can't take the federal funds rate any lower than zero. I believe that the Fed's novel programs are stimulating the flow of credit, but they simply aren't as powerful levers as large rate cuts. So this time, monetary policy alone can't power a rapid recovery. History also teaches that it often takes a long time to recover from downturns that have been caused by a financial crisis. In particular, financial institutions and markets just won't heal overnight. Our major banks have made excellent progress in establishing the capital buffers that they need to continue lending even through a downturn that's more serious than we anticipate. But they're still nursing their wounds, and credit will remain tight for some time to come. I also think that a massive shift in consumer behavior is underway, and it's one that will produce great benefits in the long run, but slow our recovery in the short run. American households entered this recession stretched to the limit with mortgage and other debts. The personal saving rate fell from around 8% of disposable income two decades ago to almost zero. Households financed their lifestyles by drawing on increasing stock market and housing wealth and by taking on higher levels of debt. But falling house and stock prices have destroyed trillions of dollars of wealth, cutting off those ready sources of cash. What's more, the stark realities of this recession have scared many households straight. It's convinced them they need to save larger fractions of their incomes. Now, in the long run, higher savings promises to channel resources from consumption to investment. That'll make capital more readily available to retool industry and fix our infrastructure. But in the here and now, such a rediscovery of thrift means fewer sales at the mall and fewer jobs on assembly lines and store counters. A fourth factor that could slow recovery is the unprecedented global nature of this recession. Neither we nor our trading partners can count on a boost from strong foreign demand, which has often been a spur to recovery in countries that have suffered a financial crisis. Finally, developments in the labor market suggest it could take several years to return to full employment. During this recession, an unusually high proportion of layoffs have been permanent as opposed to temporary, and that means workers won't get called back when conditions improve. Also, we've seen an unprecedented level of involuntary part-time work, such as state workers on furlough a few days per month. Those workers are likely to return to full-time status before new workers are hired. So to summarize, I expect that we will turn the growth corner sometime later this year, but I'm not optimistic that the economy will spring back to normal anytime soon. What's more, I expect the unemployment rate to remain painfully high for several more years. Well, I know that's a dreary prediction, but I have to add that there is also some risk that things could turn out worse. On my worry list, high, is the possibility of another shock to the still fragile financial system. Commercial real estate is a particular danger zone. Property prices are falling and vacancy rates are rising in many parts of the country. Given the weak economy, prices could fall more rapidly and developers could face tough times rolling over their loans. Many banks are heavily exposed to commercial real estate loans. An increase in defaults could add to their financial stress, prompting them to tighten credit. The Fed and Treasury are providing loans to investors in securitized commercial mortgages, and that should be a big help. But a risk remains of a severe shakeout in this sector. Well, now I want to switch gears for a minute and turn to an issue that has lately garnered a great deal of attention, and that is inflation. Just a short time ago, most economists were casting a wary eye on the risk of deflation, That is, that prices might drop, perhaps falling into a downward spiral that could squeeze the life out of the economy. Now, though, all I hear about is the danger of an outbreak of high inflation. So I'm going to put my cards on the table right away. I think the predominant risk is that inflation will be too low, not too high, over the next several years. I take 2% as a reasonable benchmark for the rate of inflation that's most compatible with the Fed's dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment. And that's also the figure that a majority of FOMC members cited as their long-run forecast for inflation, according to the minutes of the committee's April meeting. First of all, this very weak economy, if anything, is putting downward pressure on wages and prices. We've already seen a noticeable slowdown in wage growth, and reports of wage cuts have become increasingly prevalent. That's a sign of the sacrifices that some workers are making to keep their employers afloat and preserve their jobs. Businesses are also cutting prices and profit margins to boost sales. Core inflation, which is a measure that excludes volatile food and energy prices, has drifted down below 2%. With unemployment already substantial and likely to rise further, the downward pressure on wages and prices should continue and could intensify. So for these reasons, I expect core inflation will dip to about 1% over the next year and remain below 2% for several years. If the economy fails to recover soon, it is conceivable that this very low inflation could turn into outright deflation. Worse still, it's conceivable that if deflation were to intensify, we could find ourselves in a devastating spiral in which prices fall at an ever faster pace and economic activity sinks more and more. It's conceivable, but I don't view this as likely. The vigorous policy actions of the Fed and other central banks, combined with sizable fiscal stimulus here and abroad, have sent a clear message that deflation won't be tolerated. Based on measures of inflation expectations, the public appears confident that the Fed will adopt policies that will maintain a low positive rate of inflation. Evidently, the credibility that the Fed and other central banks have built over the past few decades in bringing inflation down has spilled over into a belief that we won't allow inflation to get too low either. It doesn't mean that a short episode of deflation could not possibly occur, but it makes a prolonged and devastating deflationary spiral much less likely. Now, none of what I just said is going to satisfy those people who worry about inflation. And if you listen to popular business news channels, you might hear a drumbeat of concern that the Fed could let inflation get too high. Those who hold this view point to the rise in Treasury yields and commodity prices this year as signs that runaway inflation is on the horizon. They muster three arguments. The first is that the Fed has pumped up the money supply and expanded its balance sheet to fund its financial rescue programs, potentially igniting inflation. The second is that the Fed runs the risk of repeating the errors of the 1970s by focusing on mistaken views of economic slack rather than rising prices. The third is that huge fiscal budget deficits will create higher inflation. I take all of these concerns very seriously, and I'd like to address each in turn. First, I'll talk about the Fed's balance sheet. As I discussed earlier, the Fed has taken a number of strong steps to avert a financial and economic meltdown and to support the flow of credit. These policies have caused the assets on the Fed's balance sheet to more than double, from under $900 billion at the start of the recession to over $2 trillion now. This expansion is largely financed by increases in banks' reserves, that is, surplus cash that banks have on deposit with us. Some worry that the Fed's balance sheet expansion is pumping money into the economy and will be inflationary. But as I'll explain in a moment, we have the tools needed to tighten policy and head off future inflation. There's also some concern that the Fed could be trapped by conflicting goals. If at some point a growing economy requires a higher federal funds or short-term interest rate, and that time comes before credit markets are fully healed. Finally, some worry that the Fed may lack the political will to tighten policy when the time comes. I'll be the first to say that it is always difficult to get monetary policy just right. But the Fed's analytical prowess is top-notch, and our forecasting record is second to none. The FOMC is committed to price stability and has a solid track record in achieving it. With respect to our toolkit, we certainly have the means to unwind the stimulus when the time is right. Many of the special programs we developed to provide emergency credit to the financial system are already tapering off as market conditions are improving and they're needed less. Many of the assets that we've accumulated during the crisis, such as Treasury and mortgage-backed securities, have ready markets. And the Fed can push up the federal funds rate by raising the rate of interest we pay to banks on the reserve balances they have on deposit with us. That's authority that was granted to us by Congress last year. An increase in the interest rate on these reserve balances will induce banks to lend money to us rather than to other banks and borrowers, and that would push up the federal funds rate and other rates charged to private borrowers throughout the economy. The ability to pay interest on reserves is an important tool because, as I mentioned, it's conceivable that even if the economy rebounds nicely, the credit crunch might not be fully behind us and some financial markets may still need Fed support. So this tool will enable us to tighten credit conditions even though our balance sheet wouldn't shrink. Let me turn to a second concern, that we could have a rerun of the stagflation of the 1970s. Some economists have argued that the Fed misjudged how low the unemployment rate could go then without igniting inflation, and the result was they lowered the federal funds rate too far for too long, an overly accommodative stance that contributed in the 70s to runaway inflation. This is an issue we've studied in great depth, looking at a wide range of data sources and many techniques to estimate the extent of slack in labor and product markets. It shouldn't surprise you that these estimates vary, but everyone plainly shows that labor and product markets are currently operating well below the levels that would trigger inflation. We have to be careful that we're not too overconfident we have a precise handle on this question. But to me, the evidence is clear. The economy has lots of slack, and we are far from the kinds of unemployment rates that would make inflation a danger. The third concern is that big federal budget deficits might eventually be inflationary. Now, in my years of teaching at Berkeley, I regularly lectured on the relationship between fiscal deficits and inflation. A glance at history shows that many countries with massive structural deficits and without an independent central bank turn to the printing press to pay off their debts. And that's a recipe for high inflation and, in some cases, hyperinflation. But I don't believe the United States faces that threat. Looking back in history, runaway fiscal deficits have often been accompanied by high inflation. But since World War II, such a relationship has only held in developing countries. In countries with advanced financial systems and histories of low inflation, no such connection is found. So where exactly do the dangers with fiscal deficits lie? To answer that question, it's important to distinguish between cyclical deficits and long-run or structural deficits. The recent sharp rise in the federal deficit in large part stems from the government's appropriate response to a severe recession and financial crisis. These near-term cyclical deficits vastly overstate the problem of ongoing long-term structural deficits. But the United States does have large structural budget deficit, and it's going to remain when the economy finally recovers. To a great extent, the structural budget gap reflects demographic shifts resulting in an aging population, coupled with chronic escalation in healthcare costs. The issue of rising entitlement in healthcare spending is not new. In fact, I spent many of my waking hours grappling with exactly these problems a decade ago when I served as chair of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Clinton administration. It is essential to come to grips with structural budget deficits, but it's not because such deficits will cause inflation. It's because large sustained structural deficits vacuum up savings that could be put to more productive uses. Once the economy is back on track, we're closer to full employment, these deficits will make capital more expensive for private borrowers, and that will crowd out the investments that are essential to boost productivity and fuel growth in real wages and living standards. Consider the case of the large deficits in the U.S. in the 1980s. We did not see a run-up in inflation then. On the contrary, the deficit soared just as inflation was coming down. But those deficits did contribute to higher interest rates, and that made education and investment more expensive. Another example comes from Japan. Japan has run very large fiscal deficits through much of the past two decades. But its problem is persistent deflation, precisely the opposite of inflation. Finally, I want to say there's the matter of whether the Fed's resolve is firm enough to tighten policy when the time comes to do so. And here I want to be unequivocal. The Fed is committed to doing everything in its power to foster recovery while maintaining price stability. When it's necessary to withdraw the extraordinary stimulus we've put in place, we won't hesitate. The Fed was created as a politically independent central bank, and that tradition is deeply embedded in our culture and practice. We've worked closely with the Treasury and other agencies during this crisis, and it was appropriate to do so. But in our conduct of monetary policy, we're guided solely by our statutory mandates of maximum employment and price stability. In March, the Treasury Department and the Fed signed an accord reaffirming our independence in setting monetary policy. In sum, although I take these concerns about inflation seriously, I don't believe there's a real threat of high inflation in the current situation. Monetary policy fosters inflation when it loosens financial conditions enough to create excess demand for goods and services. What could be clearer than the fact that right now we need more demand, not less, to offset the slack in labor and product markets? If anything, I'm more concerned that we will be tempted to tighten policy too soon, thereby aborting recovery. That's just what happened in 1936, when following 2 years of robust recovery, the Fed tightened policy because it was worried about large quantities of excess reserves in the banking system. The result? In 1937, the economy plunged back into a deep recession. Japan, too, learned that hard lesson in the 1990s when both monetary and fiscal policies were tightened in the mistaken belief that the economy was rebounding. These episodes teach us a valuable lesson we should heed in the present situation. Let this not be another 1937, but a time when policymakers have the wisdom and patience to nurse the economy back to health. And when the economy does come back, let it be built on a foundation of sound private investment and sustainable public policies. Only then can we be confident that we can escape destructive boom-bust cycles and build a more permanent prosperity. Let me stop there, and I thank you for your close attention.
I want to thank Dr. Yellen for her remarks here this evening, and we've been listening to Dr. Janet Yellen, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And we do have a number of questions. A lot of them certainly touched on the question of inflation, which you had touched on, and maybe there'll be some other things we can expand on. But I thought this was a good one to start with because it says, let's start at the beginning. Please explain why the dollar in my pocket is called a Federal Reserve note. What is the relationship between the Fed and the U.S. Mint?
Well, that's a good question, and it is a basic question. It says Federal Reserve notes because these notes are liabilities of the Federal Reserve System. They are the liabilities that predominantly, until this recent crisis, that are the vast bulk of the liabilities of the Federal Reserve. And when we create these Federal Reserve notes, put them into circulation, we acquire Treasury notes on Treasury bills, largely Treasury securities, as assets that offset those on the asset side of our balance sheet. Because our liabilities, these Federal Reserve notes, pay no interest, and our assets, which are holdings of Treasury securities, pay positive interest, we earn a very large income, which is known sometimes as seniorage, and the lion's share of that we give back to the U.S. government, taking a little bit of it to pay our expenses. The role of the Mint is to print the bills and to issue them to the Federal Reserve to put into circulation.
This questioner is wondering about the recent Chinese initiative, if we can call it that, to possibly replace the U.S. dollar with an alternative reserve currency. What do you think about that, how it would affect the dollar, and was that just a passing fancy?
Well, the government of China is a very large holder of U.S. government securities, and they have acquired these securities over many years, in part because their economy is export-dependent, and they have been reluctant to allow market forces to push the value of their currency as high as it would go without their intervention. And so to slow the rise of the value of their currency vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar, which would make their goods and services more expensive to everyone outside China who buys so many of them, they have sought to buy up U.S. dollars in order to hold down the value of their currency. So they've become very large holders of U.S. treasuries. And as holders, they are, of course, concerned about the value of the dollar, and that's logical, and they express that concern in a number of ways, including the proposal that the questioner is referring to. Now, I think it's clear that the idea of having a reserve currency other than the U.S. dollar would be a very long-term idea. The SDR is a basket essentially defined as a basket of currencies that includes with the U.S. dollar with a heavy weight, but includes other currencies, including the euro and the yen as well. And many decades ago, there was a great deal of discussion and even the beginnings of a plan to increase reliance on special drawing rights as a way for central banks to hold reserves. And this is really something that never came to fruition and is a really a long-term idea that would be not practical, I think, at the current time.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Dr. Janet Yellen, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Dr. Yellen, is our capitalistic system as we know it and as we have grown to know it, is it at risk? How would you characterize it as some kind of hybrid? And are there any lessons from history for us?
Well, that's a very large question and a very important one, and I don't think I can do justice to it in the couple of seconds I have. But I would say capitalism as a system works. It is the best economic system that the world is known in. I believe it is alive and well in the United States. But market systems do have failures, and those failures call for regulation and for government intervention to make the system work in a better way. One of the reasons traditionally the United States has had such strong, well-functioning financial markets is because government has provided a stable base of regulation to make sure those markets work well, to protect investors, to make sure that the markets aren't manipulated, that they're fair, they're efficient, and transparent. And it's because of strong and appropriate regulation that makes markets work well. I believe that's necessary for a capitalist system to thrive. I think that what we're seeing now, we've discovered flaws in the way we've regulated financial markets and supervised financial institutions. The reasons for that are complex, but I believe that over the next year or two, we will begin to put in place the necessary remedies to make financial markets and the economy stronger so that capitalism can function well. But I believe it to be alive and well.
So following on that question with regard to regulation, there has been talk about a new regulatory scheme and that the Fed role would be a prominent one in that. And then with regard to this issue of regulations, if you'd expand a little bit on that, is there a greater risk on the under-regulating or over-regulating, since the pendulum always seems to swing to extremes?
Well, on the under-regulating and over-regulating, it is a delicate balance because regulations have both costs and benefits. And in fact, precisely for that reason, government agencies are forced to go through a process before they put out and issue new regulations, cost-benefit analysis to weigh the costs and benefits of these regulations and to make the case publicly that the benefits exceed the costs. I think that's appropriate. With respect to the Fed's role in the regulatory and supervisory system, the Treasury has recently put out a proposal that I think will be considered by Congress within the next several months, and I think it contains a lot of important features that will strengthen our financial system. in some ways enhance the Fed's role somewhat in supervising financial institutions, and I hope will, I certainly wouldn't say eliminate all future financial crises. That's probably not going to occur. But I hope that it will mean we're a lot less likely in the future to see anything as severe as we had. The Treasury, for example, is asking Congress to establish the Federal Reserve as a systemic risk regulator. And what that would mean is that the Fed would have authority to set standards, adjust capital and liquidity levels, and appropriate risk management practices for any financial institution that is, let's say, too large or too interconnected to fail, namely any institution that could pose a severe threat to our country's financial entire system. And it's important that this would go beyond banking organizations. It would apply to any institution. At the start of this crisis, we had investment banks that now the remaining ones have all become bank holding companies. But at the outset of this crisis, they were not regulated, subject to comprehensive supervision by the Fed. And there could be other companies, an AIG, a huge insurance company with that type of risk profile, conceivably a large hedge fund, and we would be given a responsibility to identify those institutions that are systemically important and to supervise them in a comprehensive way. So I think that's very important. A financial council would also be established, whose job it would be to attempt to work with the Fed would be part of it, to monitor the overall financial system to try to identify risks that could be damaging and result in a financial crisis. An example would be the securitization practices that were so dangerous that played an important role in causing this last crisis, or potentially to identify something like declines in underwriting standards that had reached the point where, perhaps in conjunction with having a bubble in housing prices, that could be identified as a phenomenon that creates financial risk for the economy. And those are important components of the plan. So in some ways, they would certainly enhance the Fed's role.
We're listening to Janet Yellen, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, and this is the Commonwealth Club. Some economists have, according to this questioner, predicted that the natural rate of unemployment has risen from an old 4.5% to 5.5% or even higher. And some other questioners were also wondering about some of the other human impact. As you mentioned, this has been a flesh and blood kind of impact that these have had. And some of these questions could not only relate to this, whether we'll be living with higher levels of unemployment, but what your crystal ball sees about careers with regard to the financial sector being so badly demolished and so forth. What do you see in those two areas?
Well, you know, we have had some sectors of the economy that have been seriously damaged and maybe will permanently shrink below the levels they had reached as a consequence of what's gone on. The financial sector may contract. Certainly, housing construction was a sector that had expanded beyond sustainable levels. And as we try to get the economy back moving toward full employment, we know that people will have to leave these sectors and move and find jobs in other sectors of the economy. That can involve retraining. It can involve a longer time of being unemployed and attempting to retool, to gain skills, That's why, in part, we've seen such a high level of permanent job losses in this economy. And so when people say the so-called natural rate of unemployment may have risen above 4.5, I suppose I would have put it myself at 4.75 before the financial crisis. Some people would say yes, because of the need for people to move and the time it takes from one sector of the economy to another, maybe the natural rate of unemployment, or the rate below which, if we tried to push the economy right now, we might develop inflation, perhaps that has risen as high as 5 or 5.5%. But I guess what I try to emphasize in my remarks is, even for somebody who believes it's as high as 5.5 or even 6%, well, higher than I think, we're at 9.4% unemployment, and that is many percentage points of unemployment above what anybody thinks is the level, the so-called NIRU, the level below which you would begin to encounter inflation if we could expand the economy that far. Capacity utilization in industry in the United States is at the lowest level since 1948, when they started the series. So, yes, there are some structural changes that need to occur in the economy, and they're sufficiently large that if we could, if we had a magic bullet that could stimulate this economy so much we could drive unemployment down to any level we wanted, someone who felt this, had this analysis, might say, oh, gee, you better be really careful. If you try to drive the economy to unemployment now, do something that in the next year or two would push it to below 5.5%, let's say, gee, inflation might begin to rise. Okay, maybe that's true, but we're nowhere close. And we, you know, we need every bullet, every tool we have in our arsenal to try to get somewhere. I would be thrilled if I thought in the next 2 years the economy were going to hit 6% unemployment.
So we have time for one last question, and a number of questioners were wondering about the nature of the recovery, and realizing it's an interconnected and interdependent global economy, but with regard to our local San Francisco Bay Area economy, about our state, the nation, and the globe, do you see different responses going forward and different kinds of recovery, if you just comment on those areas?
You mean with respect to the Bay Area and
with respect
California?
To how you see the San Francisco area, perhaps then the state as a whole, our nation as a whole, will each of those be moving in tandem, or do you see some staggered sort of recovery?
Well, you know, in general, California and states tend to move with the nation as a whole, and we've certainly seen that for California and for my whole district, the 12th district, the 9 western states. But every local area and every state are a little bit different in terms of the composition of their industrial activity, and therefore the way in which their recovery proceeds or how badly they're affected by a downturn can differ from the national picture. So you remember during the last recession in 2001, that was a recession that really started with a collapse in tech spending. And the Bay Area is so heavily focused on IT. It is such an important industry relative to the Bay Area that Northern California was really clobbered in the last downturn. In the downturn before that, in the early 90s, it was Southern California. There was a big cutback in defense spending, and the downturn disproportionately affected Southern California. Now, for us, the Bay Area, our unemployment rate stands at 10.1%. California is even higher. In part, we've been affected by the downturn in the global economy, and also beginning late last year at the end of 2008, and this has continued through the first part of through 2009 as well, we've had a sharp cutback in investment spending, capital spending by businesses, and particularly for technology and software. And so the Bay Area has seen an enormous deterioration in revenue and employment over the last 9 months or so. We've also seen venture capital financing declining sharply in recent months, IPO activity, which is important to so many Silicon Valley firms and firms more generally in the West, has been very low. Housing, of course, we've been very badly affected by the downturn, but we're beginning to see, while both California and the Bay Area were more saw worse shakeout on the housing front than the nation as a whole, I think we're beginning to see signs of stabilization. In fact, this morning, I believe for the first time, there are many series on home prices, but one series called the Case-Shiller Index was removed, came out this morning. And it showed that at least over the last month, San Francisco Bay Area home prices are up slightly. Now, over the last 12 months, this series says Bay Area home prices are down 28%, but at least there's some sign of stabilization there. So
I want to thank Dr. Janet Yellen for her tremendous insights and remarks this evening. Let's please give her a hand. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.